Washington, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the nation's capital is finalizing its list of witnesses who will be called to testify when hearings begin June 9th. Those witnesses will try, in part, to explain how former President Trump's claims, without evidence, of election fraud led to a mob attempting to stop the certification of the election. It's been almost a year and a half since that day shocked the nation, and while our emotions might not be quite as fried as they were January 6th, 2021, everyone from that House Select Committee to everyday Americans is still wondering, what can we do to restore faith in our democracy? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Last week, I was honored to moderate a panel discussion that explored that question. It was part of an event hosted by the George W. Bush Presidential Center, and the participants were people who wake up every day and go to work focused on securing our elections. Joining me were Bill Gates, who is chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, New Mexico Secretary of State Maggie Toulouse Oliver, and Joanna Lydgate, founder and CEO of States United Democracy Center. As many states, including Texas, wrap up primaries and runoffs ahead of November's midterms, I thought we'd spend today listening back to that discussion, which took place in front of a live audience at the Bush Center.
Thrilled to have you all here. I want to start with this. Has this distrust in election results that we've seen recently been driven by actual evidence of malfeasance or by something else?
It's definitely not driven by actual evidence of anything. What we're seeing right now in this country, and I can speak to the national trend, nobody can speak better to the facts on the ground than these two, is a systematic effort to undermine the integrity of our elections with zero factual backing. And really the way we think about it at States United, we provide legal support and research support to state officials who run, oversee, protect, defend our elections. The way we think about it is, it's basically a three-part playbook. It's change the rules and change the referees so that you can change the outcome. Changing the rules is, you know, the bills we see being introduced across the country that would interfere with the way elections are run, election hijacking bills. Change the referees is an effort to run election deniers against the really amazing people who stood up on both sides of the aisle and protected our elections in 2020. And of course, the worst case scenario would be an ability to change the outcome. But these two are evidence of, they are two of the many thousands of incredible officials across the country who are such experts at what they do and just so good at it.
And I would say, you know, in Maricopa County, I think everyone's familiar with what we've gone through, the audit put on by the Arizona State Senate. I would argue that Maricopa County's election in 2020 is the most scrutinized election in the history of the world. I really think so. And you go through all that, and there is no evidence.
That's right.
And what they've done is they've sort of asked these open-ended questions and made suggestions, but never been able to point to specific fraud or to systemic fraud in particular. And what we've done on the Board of Supervisors is responded each time with one report responding to the Cyber Ninjas, 100-page report going through step by step. There's no evidence. All they do is they ask these questions, these open-ended questions, and then that is seized upon, sadly, by other Republican elected officials to point to as proof of systemic fraud.
We had our own little version of the Maricopa audit in a small county, a small rural county in New Mexico recently, Otero County. We had a cyber ninja type, if you will, audit that was conducted. And what I found hilarious, in addition to the fact, it never should have happened in the first place. The local county commission decided to let it go ahead. And now they are venue shopping to other county commissions across the state to try to get them to engage in the same thing. But they're coming forward with these supposed algorithms that these supposed experts have cooked up. And first of all, Otero County, very heavily Republican, went very strongly for former President Trump. What was to audit? But their algorithm suggested that the vote should have been much higher, much, much higher. And so that is the supposed evidence. And it's really scary when you can, as you said, Joanna, basically come forward with nothing and convince a governing body to do this type of thing.
Just briefly, I want to talk about standard verification and auditing processes that happen before and after every election. People might want to know, if there was something askance, how would you know?
We could be here all day talking about the efforts that go into long before the election and long after the election to ensure an accurate count. It starts with logic and accuracy testing of voting tabulators before they even go out into the field to make sure that they're counting ballots accurately. It goes to training of poll workers. It goes to extremely detailed chains of custody so that we know at every time where every ballot box, every tabulator, every poll check-in station is and who is using it and that only authorized users are using it. But most importantly, every single process that we do on the front and back end, including three levels in my state of canvas and a post-election audit and automatic recounts, if you want that too, we have bipartisan and transparent processes in every single step of this process, with eyes on every single step.
And I think that's a great point, is that this isn't happening in a vacuum. There are incredible levels of checks and double checks, but we have the political parties there. They're part of this. For example, in Maricopa County, the audits, now I'm not talking about the state Senate audit, but the hand count audit that we do after each election, it's the parties who conduct it, okay? So they're involved in that, and that is a very important part for people to understand. And this is what I say to people, and again, sadly, there are so many people in my party, current elected officials and folks that are running right now, for statewide offices, election positions, and others. This, the big lie that they're pushing, it assumes that literally thousands of people are in on it.
That's right.
That's the only way that this works. And I think people need to realize this. You could have a couple sort of rogue actors, and there is fraud. And we find it every year, and it's prosecuted. But what they are alleging, including the former president, is systemic fraud that literally would have involved a conspiracy of thousands of people.
So the fraud that you do find here and there every year, what does that look like?
Well, I mean, it could be, you know, it could, for example, we have mail-in voting is very significant in Arizona. We've been doing it since the 1990s. You know, let's say, for example, sadly, and we had some of these examples in 2020, where you had a person in the house passed away, okay, and a family member voted that person's ballot. It's things of that sort that we're seeing, you know, onesie-twosies.
Case by case basis.
Case by case.
People registered to vote in two different states. People registering under a false name. Very rare, but it does happen.
And Chris, as a former prosecutor, I'll just say when there are instances of fraud, which again are, you know, start with a 0.00%, there are also really strong laws in place and
That's
really
right.
strong accountability mechanisms. And, you know, I think part of this is about Americans better understanding the system. I was so happy to hear earlier the emphasis on civics education. And really, I think a lot of people are used to, they drop off their ballot, they get their sticker, that's kind of the last they think about it. But there's amazing people who are making sure that the system functions and that it's accurate.
Some folks who really like a candidate who lost, a party that didn't take an election, might think, well, why not contest everything just to be sure? What is the effect of frivolous or fraudulent claims of election irregularities on our ability to trust elections overall?
Well, I think it's been huge, and you know, I can't capture it better than the last panel did, but I will say, this was not only the most heavily scrutinized election, not just in Maricopa, but across the country, also the most heavily litigated election we've ever had. And judges on both sides of the aisle, Trump-appointed judges included, rejected all of those claims. I think the problem we have today is that those lies haven't gone anywhere. So we all watched an insurrection on January 6th. There's been a quiet insurrection that has continued since then, and it hasn't been televised. And, you know, what we're seeing is a distrust that feeds continued election lies, conspiracy theories, again, completely unfounded, And now this trend of people running for office, you know, on those lies as a campaign platform. So we have a lot of work to do in this country to spread good and accurate, truthful information. I think that's one thing that, you know, certainly everyone in this room and everyone in the business community and sort of elsewhere can be thinking about in this moment.
I also sort of worry about the boy who cried wolf effect. I mean, if every single little possible thing is challenged, and frankly, not just necessarily questioned, you know, Bill's getting a call, I'm getting a call, a county clerk in my state is getting a call, but, you know, federal court, you know, state Supreme Court, at some point, if every little problem is that level of a problem, then nothing's a problem, mm-hmm. right? And so we'll all start to tune out and not pay attention to the real issues that do need to be addressed every single election.
And so my background before I got on the Board of Supervisors was one of the things that I did in my free time was I was an election lawyer for the Republican Party. So I trained observers to go into the polling places and the lawyers that assisted them. I don't have a problem with lawsuits. I don't have a problem challenging this. There's a system and it works. And obviously 2020, heavily litigated. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is when that process is completed, people continuing to push forward. For example, in Arizona, an extra legal audit by the state Senate. I call it extra legal because it wasn't in law.
Yep.
They made it up as they went along. Those are the sorts of things that erode at the foundations of democracy.
How does the cost of an audit like that compare with the cost of a standard post-election audit that might happen every time a contest is run?
The financial cost or the...
Well, let's just talk about the financial cost, yeah. How does it compare?
I think these folks are grifters. Because they are raising tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars. They may be spending some of that money on the actual act of the so-called audit. You know, in New Mexico, it costs us maybe $10,000, $15,000 to conduct our mandatory post-election audit. For the Otero County, just again, one very small county in New Mexico, $50,000 contract was awarded. And that's to say nothing of the money that they raised mm-hmm. from the Big Light community on top of that. And I'll tell you what, we have no idea where that money is going. I'm guessing straight into these folks' pockets.
And I would say the same thing in Arizona. We're not sure how much the state Senate audit cost, but I can tell you just for Maricopa County alone, the cost to Maricopa County taxpayers has been northward of $6 million. For example, they took our elections machines and our tabulation equipment. They used it. We can't use it anymore. So we had to get rid of it. So that was $4 million to get new machines, new tabulators. Then we've had legal bills. I mean, we have been, there's been a lot of litigation. My colleagues and I were one vote of the state Senate away from being held in contempt and possibly jailed. And now we've been the subject of a criminal investigation from AG Mark Brnovich, which is based on the Cyber Ninja report that was handed to him in September of 2021. So we're talking millions and millions of dollars because, in part, there's no roadmap for this. There's no statutes that anyone is following.
A survey conducted by the Brennan Center for Justice last year found that one in six elections officials across this country, that's one in six of thousands of people, have experienced threats. I wonder if both of you could talk a little bit about how you've been affected by this.
Yep. So unfortunately, that's something that my colleagues and I have experienced. Again, I think in particular because it has been very high profile in Maricopa County. On the evening of January 6th, 2021, my family and I, we spent the evening at an Airbnb in Scottsdale because that's what we were advised to do. There was a guillotine that was set up outside of the Arizona Capitol that was for the Board of Supervisors. We had the night that the state Senate was one vote short of holding us in contempt. At my house, we had two sheriff's deputies that were there overnight. That's the only way that, you know, we were all sort of able to sleep because we thought that folks may come and sort of finish the job that the state Senate failed to do. And it affects our staff, too. They get phone calls, you know, saying that their boss should get an Alabama necktie. It's just awful. It's reprehensible. And, you know, for me, I ran for office. I've sort of, you know, prepared for exposure and some of these issues. But for our good elections workers who feel like they have to have a gun when they go out, how did we get here? Yeah. I mean, that's, so it is a major concern. And I really am trying to figure out how we reach out to the next generation of elections workers and encourage them to continue to do the job.
Exactly. And I, you know, at first was reluctant to tell my story because I didn't want to add fuel to the fire. But I think it's very important that we do tell our stories because we are human beings. We're people with families. I spent all of the Christmas holiday between Thanksgiving and January 6th, basically in 2020-2021, somewhere else than my home in Santa Fe because I was doxxed. My picture was placed on a website with a target over my face. There was a Bitcoin wallet that was collecting donated Bitcoin for bounties on my head and the head of 70 other election officials across the country, calling us enemies of the people. Like you, I had to have state police detail for part of that time, and I was able to go home briefly for Christmas. The worst part is I'm a single mom, and I have a great co-parent in my son's dad, but to keep him safe, I sent him to go stay at his dad's house, and I relocated myself for the bulk of that Christmas holiday. Now, I'm safe, I'm healthy, I'm alive, my family is safe and healthy, but not only was that emotionally painful, obviously, but of course now I'm heading into this next election year, and Bill, I'm sure you and your team, and that's the other thing, the toll that it takes on our staff, as you mentioned. It's you know, we're human beings all trying to do a really important job. As was mentioned on the last panel, we're not perfect. We are never going to be because we're humans, but we're human.
Is it harder to retain staff?
Oh, gosh. Hiring qualified staff and poll officials and quite frankly, the burnout that my staff is going through, the burnout that county election staff are going through, it's really bad right now. And if we want to keep our democracy as professionalized as it is and continue to grow it and improve it, something's got to give.
Unfortunately, these stories are representative of what we hear all across the country. You mentioned the 1 in 6 statistic, but that same Brennan report also found that 1 in 3 election officials says they feel unsafe in their job. That's absurd, it's shocking, it's un-American, it goes against everything we stand for as a country. And, you know, Mr. Chairman, you said I ran for office, but you did not run for office expecting to be dealing with this kind of stuff, nor should you, nor should anyone. And we definitely see the pattern of targeting families, targeting children, spouses, doxing. You know, when I talked about this trend of trying to kind of replace the referees, replace the good people who run and oversee our elections on a bipartisan, nonpartisan basis, this is part of it too. It's not just about running people against them. It's also about really, I think, trying to drive them out of office with threats and harassment. And the ultimate fear, of course, is that good people who are committed to this work, who are the experts in the work, won't want to do it anymore.
And I would agree with that, but I've been very pleased that our workers in Maricopa County who have been subjected to so much have stuck around. We've actually had very little turnover. I think they're committed to the effort, but it takes that type of commitment. And again, the burnout that they talked about, that's a real issue. And we are headed right into the 2022 election. But unfortunately, we keep getting pulled back to the 2020 election. And on that point, I want to be very clear. I'm not opposed to audits. I support audits. What I'm opposed to are audits that are run by partisans, that are not experts. And that's my concern. And that's, again, what the Arizona State Senate audit was.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks on that because, Bill, you're a Republican. Maggie, you're a Democrat. Some people might assume that because that's your party affiliation, that carries with you into elected office. Can you talk a little bit about the vows one takes when one accepts a position such as either of you have?
Well, first and foremost, we swear an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, the Constitution and laws of our state. Period, end of story. Do we have occasional discretion in our duties where we have to make judgment calls? Yes. But, you know, if you look at my record, I've run, five general elections, either run on the ground as a county clerk or overseen now as a Secretary of State, four presidential elections. Different folks have won. Different races. We've elected Democratic governors under my tenure and Republican governors. We've elected Democratic and Republican members of the House of Representatives. And so I think, you know, if you sort of take the totality of the work that we do, if we were just throwing elections left and right all the time, I think you'd see a trend towards different outcomes.
Yeah, and you know, for us, we actually have 50 lines of business that we're in at the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. So this is just one thing that we do. It's very important, but it's one thing that we do. And the structure that we have a county recorder who has part of the responsibilities for elections, and then the 5-member Board of Supervisors has responsibilities. So we're bipartisan, and that's what it's all about. I was originally elected the Phoenix City Council, which is nonpartisan. I view this as a nonpartisan role, period. And I took two oaths. I took an oath as an attorney and an oath as a member of the Board of Supervisors to follow the laws of the state of Arizona and the Constitution of the United States. That's my role. I understood, as well as my colleagues did, that when we voted to certify an election in which Joe Biden won Maricopa County, we knew that we were all putting our political careers at risk. But none of us had a second thought about that, because this is what we had to do. And so, yes, have I disappointed a lot of members of my party? I have, and they've been vocal about it. And, you know, but I have to accept that, because this, as the earlier panel talked about, this democracy and whether we continue, the house with the squeaky pipes or the faulty pipes continues, is dependent upon all of us doing our jobs.
That's exactly right.
We've talked about groups raising objections without evidence to election results that they didn't care for. What about people who run for public office? Do those who don't win have an ethical obligation to concede clearly and publicly that they have been defeated?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the foundation of our system, that, you know, the winner will win and the loser will concede the race. And, you know, as was discussed earlier, that's what we've always seen in this country. I want to just add to the point about the elections that you guys oversaw. You know, there were also Republicans down the ballot who won those races, right? And you know, it's one particular race that we saw so heavily contested. So, I think this trend is something that is all of this is new to us as a country. I understand the historical comparisons, of course, but what we're seeing today, you know, this is all really unprecedented.
We've also arrived at a moment when people who claim that election results can't be trusted in various parts of the country are now throwing their hats in the ring to run for office themselves. I'm curious about how any of you thinks that might sort of complicate the next few years.
I'm deeply concerned about it for a number of reasons, not the least of which is I'm very active in our National Association of Secretaries of State. I'm the immediate past president. We are the oldest bipartisan organization of elected officials in the country. And we have a proud history of that bipartisanship and coming together at the table. And have there been difficult conversations? Have folks raised voices? Absolutely, over the years. I am positive. And I hate to say this, but I am positive that we are going to have folks come into this organization next year who look out, we're all looking out the window, and we're all saying the sky's blue, and they're saying, no, it's purple. And if we can't even have a basic agreement about what color the sky is, so to speak, we're going to have a really hard time moving forward. And, of course, there's plenty of other very obvious reasons why people getting into office for the sole purpose of being able to oversee the election in order to help one person win is a problem.
Yeah, and so on that point, they're doing one of two things. Either they're going to do what they're saying they're going to do, which is to put the finger on the scale in the favor of their party's candidate, or they're being incredibly cynical, They think that they can say this to get the votes,
right.
And then once they get in office, they're going to act like, you know, all these other secretaries of state and other elections officials have. And I think some of them think they're going to do that, and they don't realize they're playing with fire. They're playing with fire when they do that. And those folks who voted for them because they thought they were going to put the finger on the scale, they're going to be very disappointed. This is, again, the thing that the earlier panel was talking about,
right.
About playing with, you know, playing with our democracy and putting it at risk in a way that it really has rarely ever been done before in our history.
It's a dynamic that is really pervasive. It's 2 out of 3 races for governor and secretary of state right now in this country have someone who's an election denier, and about half of the races for attorney general. And those are just the statewides, right? And these are people who are Stop the Steal supporters. These are people who continue to deny the results from 2020. Some attended the rally at the US Capitol on January 6th. So it's really serious. And you know, the reason our democracy prevailed in 2020, in my view, is because you had a handful of really strong election officials who stood up and who did the right thing. And many of them were Republicans. And they put country over party.
That's right.
So I think we need to take people at their word when they say what they're going to do if they're elected. And you know, we've seen what some people will do when they're elected and how important that is to our country.
Just to go back very briefly to the question of violence, and I'm sorry to dwell on this, but often when we hear about threats of physical violence in particular, the solution is increased law enforcement presence everywhere, including at polling places. I see you
can't
shaking
do it.
Your head.
Can't do it. Yeah, that's it's such a, and I'm sure Bill can relate to this at the county level even more than I can right now. It's such a challenge because, of course, we want voters to feel safe. We want poll workers to feel safe. We want to know if there are threats to public safety happening in or around polling locations to prevent that from happening. So it's a real challenge because we cannot have uniformed law enforcement patrolling polling places because that has an intimidating and chilling effect. People will not turn out to the polls. In fact, it was a huge tactic during the Jim Crow era to have police patrolling around polling places to discourage folks from voting. So we have to be really creative and think. So for example, in my state, we have a huge partnership between federal, state, and local law enforcement at every level that we are in constant communication in and around Election Day in a virtual situation room so that if an issue does arise, we can immediately dispatch the appropriate level of response to deal with that issue in that moment as opposed to, but it's hard. It's challenging to do that.
Yeah, and we have a similar structure in Maricopa County and in Arizona. You know, there are things that we didn't know that Maricopa County was going to become ground zero immediately after the election. And so as a result, as I've said before, you know, that area outside of where the ballots are being counted sort of became Lollapalooza for the alt-right. And Alex Jones and all these guys were out there, and it became a dangerous situation. Our sheriff's department stepped up very quickly. Some of those costs that I mentioned to you, hundreds of thousands of dollars in fencing to fortify, to protect all of our elections workers who are in there counting. And then also when the ballots are coming back from the polling places, we have sheriffs along with the caravans to protect them in case, you know, some people decide to engage in funny business as well. So it's something that we take very seriously. We didn't expect what we saw in 2020, but still sheriff's department and other local law enforcement stepped up. And we are getting even more prepared in 2022 because we're concerned that people may say, hey, let's, you know, like TSA, let's test things out here for 2024. So we've got to be ready for everything.
I come from a law enforcement background, and I'll just add that, you know, I think we at States United, we work with an incredible team of policing experts and law enforcement leaders across the country who did an amazing job in 2020 really sending a message to the public that voter intimidation wouldn't be tolerated, protecting polling and counting sites in a way that was appropriate. And of course, law enforcement can and has been weaponized, and it's a difficult balance. But certainly the law enforcement leaders we work with would tell you that when they take that oath to protect their country, to protect their community, and to protect the Constitution, that's an oath to protect our democracy. And the role law enforcement plays here is really critical, and especially when it comes to now what we're seeing in terms of threats to election officials and the need, the real need for accountability at the national, state, and local level.
Should there be criminal or civil penalties for people who allege elections malfeasance without evidence?
I'll let you guys take that one.
Yeah, I wouldn't support that. Again, we need to make sure that we don't chill free speech. I have no problem with this. Again, if they have concerns, we have a process. They can go to the courts, and they have the First Amendment gives them that right. But the First Amendment also gives me the right to speak out against that, for my colleagues and I to debunk. And that's what we're trying to get more Republicans to do in particular, is raise their voices, push back on this, say this is not accurate, this is misinformation, and provide more and more transparency about the elections process. As I said when I became chairman this year, I said, I want this to be the most transparent election we've ever run. That's the way to address this, not by silencing speech by threatening criminal penalties.
I think the criminal penalties are appropriate when violence is threatened. Mm-hmm. And I agree that people have the right to petition the court or petition whatever the appropriate legal or other body is to have due process, to vet grievances, et cetera. You know, the courts, I think, you know, can and rightly should impose sanctions on folks when they do bring frivolous lawsuits. And that's part of, you know, in terms of the lawsuits we've had to deal with in New Mexico, and especially the more particularly frivolous lawsuits that have been brought, we've pursued asking for sanctions, we've pursued, potential disbarment or at least an investigation by the local state bar. You know, we want that accountability to keep it from to send a message that this will not be tolerated.
We've seen, you know, sanctions across the country. We've seen bar complaints filed successfully against lawyers who litigated those frivolous cases. You know, lawsuits, of course, against the insurrectionists, and all of that, I think, is really important. Part of this has to be sending a message that there are consequences for stepping outside the bounds of our democracy.
Are there concerns that all of this skepticism about whether people can trust elections keeps people from bothering to show up and vote at all?
I would say, as a Secretary of State, and I consider myself the cheerleader for democracy in my state, that is my number one concern, is that all of this will have a chilling effect. And I will tell you right now, we have a primary election that we are undergoing already. It's on June 7th in New Mexico, but we are in the early voting period. The numbers are low. Now, half my state's on fire right now, and that's another huge problem. I'm dealing with the very real issues of trying to help people vote when they're being displaced from their homes. So on top of everything else, all the other challenges. But the mis and disinformation and the effect of that, it is chilling, and that's intentional, and that's the problem.
Yeah, and I would agree with that as well. And the even bigger concern is that people, they don't trust the system. They think it's all rigged, and they stop voting, and then they pursue other things like what we saw on January 6th.
That's right.
That's the real harm. That's the real danger. That's why we've got to pull these people back in and have an agreement. Let's both parties, because it's happened in both. We've had a lot of Democrats over the years who have also questioned election results. I'm not comparing it, but it's happened on both sides. We've got to have a sort of responsibility by leaders of both parties that we need to respect. If there are issues, we raise them, we go through the courts. If there are ways that we can improve elections, let's do it. Let's go to the state legislature. Let's pass those laws. But when it's done, it's done. Respect the results and move on. We heard all the examples through our history today of when that has happened. We've got to live up to that.
That's right. I think it's all about uplifting facts, as I said earlier, but also uplifting the people who do this work. And it was really fun to sit in the audience next to these two. And, you know, one Republican, one Democrat, I'm sure they don't agree on everything, but just to watch them sitting there nodding, like everything, you know, they agree
on. This has been therapy for us today.
It's
really good.
And I think the American people need to understand, you know, the real truth of who runs our elections and what a great job they do. And I think if we can tell that story, then people will stay engaged. And they need to watch these races at the local level. So we're also trying to get the word out about that.
Yeah.
So working the polls, working at the polls is kind of grassroots civic engagement, right? It doesn't pay well, at least in Texas. I don't know if it pays well in New Mexico and Arizona. What will people learn if they sign up to be a poll worker about the process?
I wish we could get everyone to do it. I wish we could take every single person through our election center, show them the process, look at the checks and balances that we've talked about, look at the processes that are always followed. The good people who are doing this, they're not deep partisans. I mean, some of them, they have strong feelings, but they believe in the system. So if we could do that, and again, we're trying to do that through our website, putting little videos out there, showing people that process, showing how we have, when we have adjudication over a vote, right? Well, what was this person's intent? Were they voting for Biden or Trump? We've got a Republican and a Democrat sitting there coming to a determination. And if they can't come to a determination, an independent coming in. I mean, it's everything that people would hope it is. That's how the system is. Can we do better? Always. But if they would go through that, I believe that they would have much more faith in it. But instead, they're going on Facebook or worse, and they're hearing stories, they're getting disinformation on social media, and that's what they're believing.
I echo everything Bill said, and in fact, I've started stepping up how I talk about this and challenging every single person who's out there alleging that the election is rigged, supporting or taking part in a so-called audit, an extra legal audit. Get into the polls and work the election next time around. I really think it has the power to change minds on this issue, but more importantly, put your money where your mouth is. If you really think elections are being rigged in this country or in your state, get in and work the polls yourself and make sure that's not happening.
Very quickly, a lot of people may just get their news from the internet or from TV and may not be quite sure what to think about all this. Can you still be a good and devoted Republican or a good and devoted Democrat and accept the fact that someone from your party did not win?
Absolutely. That's it.
I mean, just ask Bill.
Yeah. I know a lot of people call me a rhino, but, I'm still a Republican. I still believe all the things that I have since I became a Republican when I was 18, when I started the Teenage Republican Club at my high school, and I was a college Republican at Drake University, and when I was an election lawyer for the Republican Party. Nothing has changed except I said the truth, and my colleagues did too, and a lot of people don't want to hear it. Or they do want to hear it, but they're scared to raise their voices. There's an incredible amount of intimidation going on that I never thought we would see in our country.
Thank you all for this discussion and for the work that you do.
Thank you.
That was my conversation last week about election security. At the beginning of this segment, we heard former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who was one of the many distinguished guests at the Bush Center's symposium last week on elections. I want to close our show today by hearing from another of the day's guests, John Meacham. He's a historian at Vanderbilt, former guest on the show a couple of times, and an author of books about Presidents Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, and George H.W. Bush, among others. He led off the symposium by talking about other times in our nation's history, several times, in fact, when the results of elections were questioned. Listening to him, I thought the people witnessing those events must have felt like many people do now, wondering if democracy is on its last legs. And so my hope is that in listening to Meacham's recounting of some of those events and how we persevered as a nation, maybe you'll be left with a little bit of hope about our current state of affairs. Okay, here is John Meacham.
From age to age, what I'd suggest we think of as constitutional character has validated American elections. Constitutional character. In 1800, John Adams accepted a narrow defeat at the hands of Thomas Jefferson, peacefully ceding ultimate power in the new republic. Adams did so because he believed in the Constitution even more than his not inconsiderable personal ambition. A quarter of a century later, Andrew Jackson, who was hardly the most placid of public figures, thundered against what he called a corrupt bargain, arguably the first hashtag in American history, that had cost him the presidency in the House despite his winning the popular vote. Yet that thundering took place from Nashville, not at the head of an army on the banks of the Potomac. Jackson did what statesmen of a constitutional character should do. He accepted the result, however much he hated it, and ran again according to the rules, and he won. At either end of the 1960s, Richard Nixon declined to pursue the closest of results against John F. Kennedy, and then 8 years later, Hubert Humphrey accepted an equally narrow margin of defeat. And in 2000, both Al Gore and George W. Bush demonstrated great constitutional character amid crisis and uncertainty. A winter Wednesday, December 13th, 2000, is a landmark date. In Washington, Vice President Gore conceded the election, saying, "I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country. Neither he nor I anticipated this long and difficult road. Yet it came, and now it has ended, resolved as it must be resolved through the honored institutions of our democracy." In Austin, President-elect Bush drew on 1800, on Adams and Jefferson, to call the nation to unity, quoting Jefferson, who said, "The steady character of our countrymen is a rock to which we may safely moor, unequivocal in principle, reasonable in manner." President-elect Bush added, "200 years have only strengthened the steady character of America, and so tonight I call upon that character, respect for each other, respect for our differences, generosity of spirit, and a willingness to work hard and work together to solve any problem." Constitutional character. No matter how our laws are framed, American elections depend upon the character of the powerful and of the people, the character of a Jefferson or an Adams or a Gore or a Bush. That's because elections are not clinical, but human enterprises. And they are the oxygen of democracy, for without them, democracy dies. Covenants only hold when all parties hold up their side, win or lose, and especially when you lose. Our current crisis of character, of distrust and disinformation, is far from over. May we draw strength from the storms of the past as we confront the present. In 1864, the Secretary of State, one of the more frustrated would-be presidents in American history, William Seward, told his townspeople in Auburn, New York, "I, like you, am called by my vote to determine into whose hands the precious trust shall now be confided. It is a constitutional trial, and the nation must go through it deliberately and bravely." Now we face our own hour of constitutional trial, of constitutional character. And may we meet that trial with deliberation and with bravery. We owe generations past and surely owe generations to come nothing less.
That was historian John Meacham speaking at an event last week at the Bush Center. You can like our page on Facebook. We're at KERA Think on Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcasts. You can also go to our website, think.kera.org, to listen, and you can see what's coming up on the show. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.